smart speaker.
The sound of student life in London.
This is Westminster Waves.
Anne Widdecombe was killed in a targeted attack. Counter-terrorism police have confirmed that some planning and preparation went into her murder. The 78-year-old was found dead at her home on Dartmoor last Thursday. Police have been granted a warrant to question a 28-year-old man for a further 7 days. Assistant Commissioner Lawrence Taylor spoke outside Scotland Yard.
It is important to remember that this is a murder investigation following a brutal attack on a 78-year-old lady in her own home. I want to ensure that our work is conducted sensitively and considers the impact of what has happened.
£10 billion of taxpayers' money was wasted in the scramble to buy PPE. The official COVID inquiry has criticised the vast waste in pandemic procurement. Naomi Phillip lost her mum during COVID and spoke outside the inquiry.
£10 billion, two-thirds of money spent on PPE was wasted on unusable PPE. Lives were lost as a result, including my mum's.
A man who raped and murdered his estranged wife has been jailed for life. 56-year-old Michael Thompson put Kimberly Thompson through years of domestic abuse before suffocating her in August of last year. Firefighters are under extreme pressure as they continue to battle wildfires across the country. Fire chiefs say the lack of rain for the foreseeable future is becoming increasingly problematic. Police are stepping up security in Atlanta ahead of England's World Cup semi-final against Argentina. Thousands of fans are set to descend on the city for kick-off tomorrow night. And Line of Duty star Adrian Dunbar has given a sneak peek into Series 7 of the hit drama. The actor who plays Ted Hastings is confident it'll be well-received.
Season 7, I think, is going to be pretty good. Jed's written some fabulous scripts with lots of twists and turns. I don't think we let the fans down. I think it's going to be great.
The series will air in 2027. That's the latest from Radio News Hub. I'm David Hall.
A home on our holiday park will help you relax.
Owning a holiday home will be stressful and upsetting.
It'll make money for you.
There are endless hidden costs.
Oh, yeah, we'll buy it back whenever.
We'll pay you a fraction of what it's worth. There are two sides to every story. If you bought a home on a holiday park, contact Holiday Park Advice Centre. Because if you were missold, we can help. Text JUSTICE to 78900. Fees apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to Cine Majesty, only on Westminster Waves from 6 to 7pm every Tuesday. I am your host, Logan Parker, but unlike, you know, the episode so far, this episode is special because we have our first guest, art department enthusiast, production designer, art director, Mika Lippold. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi! That was so cool seeing you, like, introduce the show and everything, because I listen every week. And it's like seeing the Mona Lisa be painted.
That is, I think, a compliment that makes me sound far more professional at my job than I actually am. But Mika, do you know the reason you've been chosen as guest? Well, have I revealed that?
I think there's two reasons, if I understand correctly. One is that I am a self-prescribed or self-described production design enthusiast, art department enthusiast. But also, contrary to what my voice sounds like, I'm actually also German. Is that it?
Yeah. but what are those two things? How are we linking those two?
Well, am I allowed to give it away?
Yeah, you can give it away. We always kind of at the start talk about, like, you know, roughly what we'll be doing. If not in detail, then yeah, just a rough outline of the topic of today's episode.
Well, what I know is that today we're going to be talking about German Expressionism, specifically, and at least from my perspective. The production design, set design aspect of it.
That's pretty spot on, and it just goes to show that I am sort of underprepared every week, because, you know, there probably shouldn't be a point with any of the guests where they're like, oh, you know, as I understand it, it's this. It should just be clear from the get-go, which gives you an insight into my general lack of preparation every time.
I wouldn't say it like that.
Every time I'm on here.
I feel ready.
We're also going to talk more broadly about some German films, their sort of cinematic identity as a country. And we're going to talk sort of experiences as production designer, what it's like to work in the art department, a department, and I've said this before, so frequently undervalued on set, underappreciated, and why, you know, why the reasons for that might be the way that they are. So, Mika, do you want to just give us a rundown of how you kind of came to be in the art department?
Well, first of all, thank you for saying that the art department is undervalued. You know me. I sound like a broken record in that regard. Like, I say it any chance I get.
You do really notice it when you're on set working in the art department. Trust me. I've been a lowly art assistant a few times, and certain other departments on set maybe don't value what the art department does.
And ironically, when I started university, I wanted to be in that said department.
We won't name it. But it's a very popular department.
Yeah, anyone who's been in the art department really knows who we're talking about. But yeah, I wanted to do something else in the beginning, but after doing it, I just didn't feel the kind of, I guess, fulfillment I thought I would get. And just on a whim, I wanted to be a production designer on our like second year film. So as part of a uni course.
What really helps me about this episode is it actually helps me fulfill the remit of this radio station, which is to kind of be like a student's perspective in London, which is great because usually I just ignore that remit and I kind of just do what I want. I'm allowed to do that. I'm not like going behind anyone's back. But the good news is about having Mika here is the fact that the love for production design Mika has kind of springs from uni. So this is the first time I think I'm actually doing my job properly, which is pretty worrying.
I'm glad I can help you out with that.
Yeah, you're doing me a huge solid there. You're making me look good in front of the big bosses.
Because how it works with our uni specifically is we get to kind of apply for a role, and I said, why not? I'll be production designer on a rom-com. And I had no idea what it was. You and I actually did a production design course in first year.
We did, yeah, with Jane Barnwell.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Yeah, shout out Jane Barnwell. She's lovely and very professional.
Oh, I love her.
And it was actually the module that I was probably the best at. So what are you thinking? You know, did you go into production design? No, obviously not, because why would I sort of do the
Subject
smart thing?
Yourself to
yeah,
that.
Why would I do the smart thing and do what I was allegedly good at? Not really my style. Jane Barnwell, shout out, the GOAT.
Really, truly. So that's when it started, because you and I both, we wanted to do the working with actors module first, but we're silly.
I want to interject there. I didn't want to do the working with actors module. No, I didn't want to do it. Because I knew that it'd be like overcrowded and...
And it was.
Yeah, I shan't say any more than that. Yeah.
Well, I think I wanted to do that, but I just never applied for it. And so the only ones that were left were like production design and a different one.
I think the other one was animation, which I didn't want to do because I'm technologically illiterate, which I've spoken about at length on this show before.
Yeah, and I wasn't about to do that either. So production design it was. And thank God, because we learned like the in and outs of the theory behind it. And I guess when I saw I had the chance to do it practically, I jumped at the opportunity, and it really, I think that project kind of changed the trajectory of my professional, I'm like a student still, but it changed what I wanted to do with my kind of film career.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think people greatly underestimate the fact that you'll come to, I want to say film school. We didn't go to a film school. It's a university which has a film course. But everyone comes in here wanting to do one thing and rarely ever leaves wanting to do that same thing. They kind of find themselves a lot more. Not in this kind of soppy way, but in the way of like figuring out, you know, maybe what you're good at on set, what your weaknesses are, stuff like that. And sometimes you pivot completely, which I think is one of the best reasons to study film, is the fact that you don't kind of give yourself tunnel vision or become like a kind of one note person, which, don't get me wrong, doesn't apply to everyone. A lot of people, you know, they know what they want to do and they follow it, but other people, you know, they get given the chance to figure out that they want to do something else, which you don't always get in life. So, you know, studying film, I'd recommend it. Controversially, I'd recommend one of the most popular subjects for study.
I agree.
But do you want to just talk a little bit about, something that makes you kind of interesting for this show is that obviously every episode we talk about sort of a new country and their sort of film industry, film culture, and sometimes it's a small snapshot of it. But you being of dual nationality, you know, do you want to talk about, I guess, like your relationship to Germany and being German and stuff like that?
I guess it's a bit of a controversial subject in my case, because I don't sound German at all. I'm actually, in case you couldn't hear it, I'm half American. I was born in America, but I left when I was six, moved to Germany. My entire family is German, except for my mom. So I went through the German education system. I think I just don't identify with the American life path or kind of childhood experiences, teenager experiences. It's just not what I did.
Very European.
I would like to think so. I think the way I think and act and even like view films or think of art, I think is from a more German / European perspective. But my voice, it always gives it away. It's so funny to actually, when people ask, oh, where are you from? They always expect me to say, California, Minnesota, and then
Boston.
Boston, that's where I'm actually from.
Shout out Boston.
Shout out Bostonians. And then when I say, oh, I'm actually from Germany, the light comes back into their eyes and they're like, oh my God, someone, you know, we can relate to. So I value that part of myself and I prioritize it, I guess. But yeah, I live there still. I've never been to America since. So I am German in every sense.
Yeah, see, you're a bit more complex than me. I'm just kind of English, you know. Only thing I'm missing is a bit of rain to make it, you know, full English, bit of bacon, sausages, eggs, stuff like that. But to actually, yeah, I guess move on to what we're actually here to talk about, German production design, or German expressionism's production design rather, and production design more broadly. Do you want to give your understanding of what the German expressionist film movement was?
Yes. So...
would have been really awkward if you said no. So,
thank you. I actually want you to do it. From my understanding, it was a movement from like the 1919 to 1930-ish. And it was broadly informed by kind of the tensions of World War One in Germany and just kind of the socioeconomic state of the world.
There's a little bit of disagreement around when the kind of movement kicked off. Some people think it started as early as 1913 with the student from Prague. But generally, a lot of people's starting point with German Expressionism is the cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
As they should.
From 1920. But generally, yeah, it's agreed to kind of fizzle out around 1930. Some people think it ended with Erich von... is it Stroheim? Let me have a look. I have notes on this.
Is he German?
Sternberg. Yes, I believe so. Erich von Sternberg's... hang on. No. What am I talking about?
I think you should say it.
Joseph von Sternberg. There we go. sorry, I was thinking of Erich von Stroheim because he's the more famous of the two and he did The Phantom Carriage, which I think might be German Expressionism. If it's German, I think it's German from 1921, which would be a huge influence later down the line. But that's not important right now. Yeah, some people think it ended with The Blue Angel by Joseph von Sternberg in 1930. Some people consider M to be German Expressionist, but...
do you?
No, not really. I'd like to, because it's one of my favourite German films. It doesn't... when you get into like what a German Expressionist film actually looks like, it's hard to argue that M fulfills that criteria particularly well, because like German Expressionism, for those of you who don't know, is kind of categorized by the externalizing of a character's inner turmoil by like exaggerated sets, chiaroscuro lighting, a lot of weird looking characters and people, with a focus on like mood more so than kind of anything else story wise. But I don't think M falls under the category. I think it's post expressionism. To sound like I'm more cultured than I am, it's post expressionist. but yeah, I wouldn't consider M it. But yeah, generally, sort of mid 1910s to 1930, kind of that 15-year period. So a bit of a, you know, it's shone brightly, but not for too long. But to kind of flip the question back on you asking about M. What's kind of, I guess, your favorite from German Expressionism?
Well, when you were talking about which film kind of represents the beginning, I wanted to defend The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
And why is that?
Because I like that one the most.
I really like that film. I think it's just, it's kind of just representative of the movement as a whole. And I also love Konrad Veidt. He's one of my favorite like people. I think he's so silly.
The kind of fun fact that always gets attached to Konrad Veidt, and I'm absolutely guilty of this, is inspiration for the Joker.
Yes.
In, I think it was in a film called The Laughing Man.
Yes.
From the late 1920s, I want to say. And that image of him in that film would go on to inspire the Joker, the you know, in the Batman comics. So he has a legacy much longer than his filmography.
But most people will know him from Casablanca, probably.
Yeah, he's the Nazi general in Casablanca. An incredible film that I'm always surprised when people, like film students, haven't seen it. It's very good.
Just watch it.
There's a quote, kind of, I don't know if it was attributed originally to Casablanca, but it's one that applies, I think, very aptly. And it's, if you have one cliche, then you just have a cliche. But if you have 1,000 cliches, you have a story. And that's what Casablanca is. It's a lot of cliches done well. But the thing is, Casablanca might be the reason those cliches are cliches. So just bear that in mind if and when you finally watch it. Anyway, back on track. Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Hit me with your thoughts on it.
Well, I was looking through, like, to kind of refresh my memory, I was looking through screenshots or, like, stills from the film, and I just had to stop and say I love production design. I love set design. I love the art behind it, because I don't actually know how it was made, but I feel like it's a lot of painted backdrops to kind of get that illusion of depth and those crazy, like, building angles.
Yeah, a lot of like forced perspectives.
Yeah, because you're not going to build all of that.
No. I mean, you could try, but one of the reasons German Expressionism kind of even exists is because, you know, it came out of financial hardship.
Yeah.
There was a ban on foreign films in 1916, which meant they had to increase native film production. In 1914, there were 24 locally produced German films, but by 1918 there were 130, and obviously, jeez, if you're making more, the cost is going to go down, and as a result, you know, you have to get clever with how you use your resources.
And what I always find interesting is that I feel like the first thing to kind of go when budgets are cut or when things are like you have to make things quickly and for less money is the art department, because
100%.
That's kind of how like the kind of like Italian neorealism movement or French New Wave, how those things originated is because they moved from the expensive, lavish studio system to location. And the first people to kind of get cut out as unnecessary were production designers and art directors, which is absolutely ludicrous because in the job description, it's these people are also involved with picking locations and adjusting these locations to the story that you need. So I guess that's why I also love The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, because it kind of leans into everything people associate with production design, like kind of these indoor sets, painted backdrops. It lets the production design speak for itself, and it's such a big part of the story. Like, you can't not notice it. And that's also a huge problem with production design. People don't notice it.
Does that idea of there's no film without the production design, does that remind you maybe of a recent release directed by someone who was only 20 years old? He's now 21.
Well, who might that be?
That really narrows it down.
Shout out to Curry Barker at this point.
Nope.
Shout out to Kane Parsons.
Yeah.
Who is now...
He's 21 now, yeah.
So you can say you're the same age. He's no longer younger
briefly,
than you.
Yeah, briefly, we are the same age. I will be 21 for 4 more months, at which point I'm certifiably unk. I will be 22, unfortunately, which means I'll be older, yeah. Anyway, yeah, does it remind you of maybe a recent film directed by a then 20-year-old?
The Back Rooms.
Yeah, The Back Rooms.
It absolutely reminds me of The Back Rooms. Especially like the way people talk about or kind of things associated with German expressionist design, not only in film, but on stage as well. I felt like I was just reading the descriptions of the back rooms. It was like the word uncanny is always there, and kind of weird perspectives and monotone, either monotone colors or like just every single color available.
Do you want to maybe just briefly break down what the uncanny is for people who might not know?
Well, uncanny. The reason why I bring this up is also I wrote my dissertation on this subject. So I love talking about production design, and especially what production design can bring to a film almost subconsciously. And I argue that almost every single set is uncanny. But in the case of backrooms, uncanny was in the sense of Freud, uncanny in German means unheimlich.
He's always sneaking into discussions of literally anything there's Freud, isn't he?
Like, pack it up.
The thing is, I feel much the same way about... I don't know if this is necessarily unique to me. He just got there first.
He did.
Like, whether or not what he was saying was right...
Or he's just the first to put a word to it.
Yeah, exactly. He was just there first. I'm not saying, you know, his name should be Sigmund Freud, but he's on Fraud Watch.
But I can't... The uncanny
anyway, sorry, continue,
cool.
Yeah, with the uncanny.
So... uncanny in German means unheimlich, which has a load of different kind of meanings. One meaning is secret, but the opposite of unheimlich is heimlich. No, sorry, heimlich means secret, but it really means, kind of literally translated, unhomely, or secret can mean homely. So the word home is kind of embedded into uncanniness, and it can describe something that feels familiar or feels like home, but isn't. And Freud kind of goes into different reasons why we think things are uncanny, either in the sense of people. People can be uncanny or things can be uncanny if they look human but aren't. For example, puppets, they look like humans, but they're not alive. So things that should be alive but aren't, that's uncanny. Things that look like a home but aren't are uncanny. And Freud actually specifically talks about setting. I wouldn't go as far as to say he says it about film sets, but he says that anything that is imagined, so anything in your imagination that is projected into real life, that is inherently uncanny. He talks about like kind of hallucinations or manifestations of kind of something you've been thinking about, but you can absolutely apply that to production design when someone imagines a setting like the back rooms or like a weird office space. When you actually see it in real life, that thing you imagined, that gives you a sense of uncanniness.
And what you think that there's maybe a cause and effect link, or maybe not cause and effect link, but a chain between, you know, stuff like the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, The Last Laugh, and back rooms. You think there's the same kind of it has a similar effect on the viewer?
I would absolutely argue that the back rooms, not necessarily the film,
it's just back rooms,
but this is why. Yeah. Like the actual back rooms.
Yeah.
Not the film, but the space, that is expressionist, in my opinion. Maybe not German expressionist, but I would say it's expressionist because of what it is meant to represent. Like if the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari is one side of the expressionist spectrum, like these really harsh contrasts and sharp angles, and it's a city but it's not, it's real but it's a dream world, then Backrooms is kind of the shy cousin of that, and it kind of relates to not the anger and despair of the First World War, but kind of the mundanity and loss of identity that modern people kind of experience or talk about experiencing. It's like I read this thing about non-spaces, where kind of in our modern capitalist society, we don't attribute emotion to spaces anymore. We go to supermarkets, there's buildings that exist just for profit or just for functionality, and not really, they don't serve a community purpose or like a fulfillment purpose. Like you don't go to the shop for enrichment, you go there for a transaction. Or all of these like banks and office buildings, like there's just a whole bunch of nothing in cities. And I think Backrooms is kind of that. Like it's an office, it's a place of work, it's a place of, you know, making profit, getting money, but it's a nothing place. There's nothing there. And of course, the back rooms kind of expand into other things as well. But the fact that there's no life there, there's nothing, but it's so familiar. I think in that sense, it's one of those modern day non-spaces. And it's expressionist in the sense that it shows what we feel in our modern world and our fast modern culture.
I did an episode a few weeks ago on New French Extremity, which deals with a lot of very awful things. I mean, it's in the name, Extremity. I think this might be the bleakest episode yet, if we're talking about all that jazz. Because each of those films, it's just people getting all mangled and stuff.
There's this a is lot existential.
This is deep. but talking, I guess, about the link between German Expressionism and then this later American production. I think one of the reasons that you don't get German backrooms, for want of a better phrase. So during the rise of Nazism, you had all of these filmmakers who were hugely influential in the Expressionist movement. They fled to America, either because of religious persecution or because they were gay. They all went to America to flee the Nazis. So what ends up happening is a lot of the American films are influenced by it. Film noir is a movement born out of American cinema, and one of the reasons for that is the people who were working on them would have had experience in German Expressionism. Though I should point out, film noir is a term coined by the French after the lifting of the ban on foreign films, and I want to say around 1950. But yeah, it's interesting to know that I guess the film that's sort of doing the rounds at the minute as the most obvious descendant of Expressionism isn't actually German, and there's a sort of very bleak reason as to why. And we've kind of briefly touched on it with the cause of German Expressionism, the influences. There was broadly an Expressionist movement in Europe at the time. You can see it in paintings The Scream from the late 1800s. I mean, that looks
iconic.
That looks like a German Expressionist film. I think the painter might have been Danish.
French? Danish?
No, I think he was Danish.
I don't know.
I'm going to say he's Danish. If he's not, I do apologise. but yeah, it was indicative of that. And it was born of World War One, and obviously ultimately fizzled out because of the rise of Nazism leading to World War Two. So it's a movement that could only exist kind of when it existed in those very specific circumstances. So yeah, maybe not the happiest of origins.
I didn't know that.
And causes. Yeah. It's the UFA. I can't remember what that stands for, but the UFA were kind of the overseeing production company of film and television in Germany during the Expressionist movement. And I want to say the Nazis likely had a role in shutting them down. If not shutting them down, then likely reworking them for, Goebbels' propaganda machine. But, not to talk about the elephant in the room when it comes to German cinema.
Every time.
Yeah.
But fair enough.
But I guess what I wanted to ask you is, and kind of get your German perspective on this, is, World War II and the Holocaust specifically were such huge events in Germany, but obviously worldwide, and a lot of the quote-unquote best films about that time period, they're not German. Is there maybe a sense that Germany... Because Germany, they had such a huge response to World War II afterwards. They made sure sort of Nazism could never happen again. It's illegal to do the salute or to, say the words. It's illegal to deny the Holocaust in Germany. Mm-hmm. So there's always been a huge response to the Holocaust in education. Do you think maybe in film there was a bit of a delayed response to it? Because you think of the kind of best films about World War II from that time period, or the Holocaust, you're thinking of films from Poland, The Last Stage, mm-hmm. You're thinking of French films. Was there, do you think, a delay in German films in responding to that?
I just want to say, from the get-go, whatever we did was not enough. In terms of kind of the denazifizierung, that's what it is in German, to kind of undo all of the systemic things that led to kind of Nazism, it's not where it needs to be nowadays. Yes, it's illegal to do anything related to it or to deny it or kind of relive it. The thought processes are still there. Our right-wing party is gaining popularity. I'm just not no one's very happy with how Germany is doing nowadays. But I do think we're all very aware, like you said, in education. Like when I was in school, every subject, if it was German class, math class, music class, we always brought it back to how these subjects were used in, like, during the Holocaust, in the Second World War. And we never forget it. That is the most important thing. And I guess I've never really thought about film's role in that, even though it's such an obvious, like, societal tool and used for propaganda as well. I guess there is a bit of a lack of response, at least from the German perspective.
Maybe not a lack of response, but maybe a delayed response. But I also wonder, you know, how much of that is due to literally not being able to make a film in the aftermath. Because I'd imagine, you know, there was a bit more paperwork going on at the time and more important matters than, you know, films.
But even nowadays, like, for example, The Zone of Interest.
Such a good film.
It's a British film.
It's British. And it's made by an English guy.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, we had All Quiet on the Western Front a few years ago. That's World War One.
That's World War One.
So it's not like we're not... There's not like there's a general lack of filmmaking about war or World War Two.
But from Germany specifically.
From Germany. Yeah. But when I think about the films I grew up with or the films we watched in school and everything, despite having it so ingrained in our education, I cannot think of a lot of German World War II films we watched. Obviously, there are a few, but even modern day, when I think of German cinema, I think of, you know, your Matthias Schweighöfer comedies. And I think that's what Germany is doing a lot of, at least when I grew up. That was kind of our change in route, I think.
When I think of German cinema, I think of Michael Haneke. I think we might be slightly
shout
different.
Out. Yeah. But he doesn't really talk about World War II either, does he?
The White Ribbon is about the rise of Nazism.
But that was technically World War One.
Yeah, but it's about the rise of Nazism.
I guess it's
set during World War One.
But yeah. Then again, because you talk about a delayed response, yeah. Should a good... adequate response be overtly or like should it be out and proud this is about World War II, or do you personally
I don't know I'm not an expert. I'm just poking the bear. I'm just probing. Meek is not the bear, by the way. I should clarify that was a poor analogy. You know, I'm circling with a stick.
I guess that's a good point that I haven't really considered how we're using film in Germany.
There was Die Brücke from 1958 or 1959, The Bridge. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that was set during World War II. But then also, like, a lot of film industries in Europe were decimated after World War II for obvious reasons. I mean, you mentioned Italian neorealism earlier. They were shooting on scraps of film that normally would have been used for, like, news reporting, like 16mm. Yeah. Or maybe not 16mm, but, you know, film stuff that wasn't typically used for films
at
the time.
But also, what I know about current German film industry, we're making a lot of Wes Anderson films up in Berlin. We're making a lot of Hunger Games films.
You have a bit of a connection to Wes Anderson, don't you?
Do I?
You know a guy.
I do, actually. I recently worked with... I don't know what his specific title is on those films, but I worked with the head sculptor of some of the Wes Anderson films. He's a great guy, Markus. If you're listening to this, he's not, because he doesn't speak English. But
luckily, you speak German.
Genau, that's why I got the job. Yeah.
You can tell him in German.
Yeah, danke für alles. Es hat mir sehr viel Spaß gemacht. But yeah, so when I think about, like, if I were to go into the German film industry now as a young film worker, I'm probably not going to stumble upon a lot of World War II films.
I mean, I should clarify, like, I am by no means an expert on, you know, post-World War II German cinema. I've seen a few Wimble Wenders films.
Sorry, that got me.
Wimble Vumble. like, for all I know, there was a huge response, and I've just completely missed it. So I do apologise if that's the case. I do not mean to disrespect anyone. And again, it could just be me being sort of in the sort of Anglophone world where the focus is on American productions and British productions and French, more so French productions than any other non-English language. That could be entirely on me and it could be my own ignorance. Probably should have looked more into that before this, but, you know,
but
I will learn.
I agree with that, though, because, I mean, I could have studied film in Germany, but I chose not to because I didn't have the sense that the German film industry was a particularly strong one nowadays.
I think it's
getting there again, okay. But it's not comparable to what, you know, you guys over here are doing.
We're mostly used for like other
tax
studios.
Reasons.
Yeah, tax reasons. We are the United Kingdom of tax evasion. Or not tax evasion, rather, but like tax write-offs and tax schemes that encourage productions to shoot here. And I'm not complaining because that means we get work. But it's funny, to go back to the kind of Anglophone perspective on German film and German expressionism, Hitchcock, he was hugely influenced by it. He went to work in Germany for a bit as an assistant director and as an art director.
Thank you. People always love to forget
that.
Yeah,
they forget he was also an art director. And you can see that if you watch his silent film, The Lodger, it's very expressionist. It's just done in London. the example people like to refer to is there's a shot, I can't remember which film it's in, but they shot from below glass ceiling. It might be The Lodger and it's meant to show someone pacing around upstairs, but obviously done in an expressionist way. I mean, expressionism by definition is anti-realism, so that's how you end up with shots like that. And there's also, I mean, it's expressionism is everywhere. I mean, Blade Runner, everyone's dad's favourite film, Blade Runner. that's, you know, that was hugely influenced by Metropolis and the kind of monumentalism of Metropolis. So yeah, the Anglophone response, and somehow that got me onto Hitchcock and Blade Runner. It happens. The Anglophone response to World War II, maybe a bit quicker than the German response, but as sort of, as we talked about earlier, that's likely because, you know, German film industry was, you know, they had more pressing matters.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. I don't think film was...
Probably wasn't high on their list, you know.
I think we had to do everything else first.
Yeah, film likely would have been on the back. When you kind of look at, these expressionist sets...
Love it.
Everyone loves them. I guess, do you see shades of them... I don't know, like, do you see shades of them in non-expressionist sets? Because in theory, yes, because everything you do, everything you construct is inherently to a degree expressionist and not just in the cinematic sense.
That's the perfect thing to say.
Yeah,
that was
sometimes
so
once
good.
In a while I have I have a zinger, something to clip and post I shouldn't do the accent. You can do the accent.
But you do it so well.
On Reels and TikTok, an app I do not use.
Short answer.
Yeah, awesome. You mentioned off mic, because sometimes, you know, I talk to my friends outside of the remit of
very
this.
Very rarely.
Yeah, outside of the remit of this show. But you were talking about six types of sets. Do you maybe want to delve into that a bit and how it relates to expressionism?
So first of all, talking about like the shades of seeing sets, I thought it was funny reading about expressionism, saying like I kind of brushed up on my theater theory, and in terms of expressionism, the kind of main takeaway is that instead of how life really looks, the important or like the priority is how the characters feel. And from an art department perspective, that's almost all we do. Or at least that's what I think most, even directors and production designers, that's what drives kind of their decisions. It's, yes, of course, like the context of the space, time, kind of financial bracket, all of these things that inform your environment. They're important, but when you're designing a set, you have to take into consideration where the characters are. Like even in so-called realist sets, kind of, and if you see a bedroom, how that character feels about themselves, about their family, about their space, how they respect their space, even down to their favorite color, what textures they like, what they think is comfortable in bed. That's character driven, and that it might not be as extremely expressive as, like, you know, the despair and fear you feel when a world war is brewing, but it's the same. It's just a smaller degree of what we express.
So everything's, I mean, in film, you're saying everything's kind of expressionist.
I would say it's just, at least from an art department perspective. I think realism, I think, has a bit of a negative connotation in terms of art department work. I've worked on a lot of sets where I give some ideas that are as simple as, why don't we add a photo here? Why don't we kind of stack these books differently? And I often get a response of, that doesn't really look real. And I always wonder, what does that mean?
I guess, yeah, what's the reference for realism when nothing's kind of consistent?
In a made-up world.
Yeah.
You know, I stack my books that way, and what? So, like you said, to a degree, everything is expressive in film. But where I got that kind of idea from, like these shades of sets, when I was researching for my dissertation, I stumbled across this lovely book that I can recommend to anybody interested in sets. It's called Sets in Motion by The Athens. They describe six, mostly five kind of degrees of sets. There's sets as denotation, which means the set is purely background. And I know I'm kind of contradicting myself when I say that something is purely background and not really expressive, but the set as denotation is just the background. It just denotes time and place. It fades into the background. It's just there as decoration, really. There's sets as punctuation, which kind of leave that denotion or denotation in key parts of the film to kind of highlight a feeling or a mood. They are, let me think. I think there are sets as embellishment. So maybe there's only five. I think I lied.
Oh, you're misinforming our audience.
I'm sorry, guys. It's been a minute since I wrote this dissertation.
Yeah, but you wrote a dissertation. You hadn't mentioned it.
I really like it, guys. It was one of my favorite things to do.
No, you should be proud. It's a good dissertation.
Thank you. There's sets as embellishment, which is kind of a higher degree of visibility of the set. You know, if you think of like Sunset Boulevard, that living room, just the grandness of it, that is set as embellishment. You kind of can't move away from it. You have to notice it. And then there's set as artifice, which is, it's just so, so in your face and so expressive that you really can't look away. And it's part of it. It's a key part of the film. And then as kind of like an overreaching category, the Athens declare that sets can be narrative. And I think that's where expressionism thrives. Any set can be part of the aforementioned four and also narrative. So a set as denotation probably won't be as likely, but can be part of the narrative if it is the story. So if you think of like bottle films, for example, films set in only one place, no matter the degree of design, the degree of visibility of design, how in your face it is, that set will be visible and will be part of the narrative if it's the only location, because the characters and the audience have the entire length of the film to kind of get to know this place. And it's you cannot, the story, the setting is the story. And I think German expressionist films are kind of in the cusp between artifice and narrative, because
it's interesting you say that, because based off your descriptions, I thought, you know, some of them sound like embellishment.
They all flow together.
Does embellishment serve less of a narrative purpose?
I mean, even denotation serves a narrative purpose. It's just how they describe it. It's how obvious is the set to the audience. So
are you saying like the how much of their attention is kind of devoted to the set as opposed to
how much the filmmakers kind of point to the set and say, hey, look, this is worth looking at.
Yeah.
Like Backrooms, to go back to that, I would say borders on its narrative.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at just the space outside of the narrative, because it's not like a bottle film, but it could be seen as as artifice, because you know there is a kind of a real world outside of it. But you cannot watch Backrooms and not think of production design. And if you do, then I think you're missing out on a key part of film viewing. You know, you're limiting yourself to what you can find attractive about a film.
But I mean, I think that's a huge issue with film criticism in general, is how often, you know, production design is kind of shafted to the side. It's frequently ignored, unless it is something like Backrooms, or it's something like Expressionism, where the whole point of it is often the production design. And this is another reason I brought you in to talk about this, is because I've always felt it's somewhat different in theatre.
Absolutely.
I think because there's no fourth wall in theatre in the way that there feels like there is in film, because of screens. I think people are a little more, their attention's grabbed a little more by the set, and they'll forgive a set not particularly looking quote-unquote realistic. And you have worked in both theatre and film. You've designed a set for a theatre show, and, you know, I guess I'd like to talk, I guess, about those differences, your working experience on working on theatre, and how, you know, the arts department is received there versus working on it in film, and how the art department is received there.
That is a very good point, because especially in terms of early set design, or even expressionism, like German expressionism, it comes from the theatre. Everything we know from film, and in terms of production design... He's giving me a disapproving face.
Yeah, you can't see. I'm doing a disapproving face.
Maybe not.
I don't like to thank theatre for anything to do with film, but that's just me being.
I think that's allowed.
Stubborn. Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. You love your film.
Yeah. Proceed.
At least from like a set design perspective, we started on stage, and in terms of like studio productions, the stage is still there. We just kind of build it differently, and the difference is, as you say, a fourth wall, or they're boxed in. Or there's no audience. You don't have to take perspective into perspective, if that makes sense.
Oh, like, that's a good way of putting it. I like that.
Thank you. Like, for the theater, you have to, even in terms of makeup or acting, you need to project to the very back. You need to design as loud as you can so everyone sees it. And obviously, if you sat in the front row or in the back row, you're gonna see more or less of the set.
Ain't that the movie we were just talking about, Back Rows?
Hello. Back Rows, yeah. I Kane Parsons. depending on where you sit in the audience, you're gonna see more or less of the frame. But in film, everyone sees the same thing, unless you're like front row in an IMAX screen, you know, then you're seeing nothing. But in an ideal world, everyone is seeing the same thing, so you kind of have more freedom in your design, because you don't have to consider perspective, or like that kind of audience perspective in film. I think obviously it's very different. Every theater production is different, and you can have expressionist theater, obviously. But from what I know,
or plastic theater.
Plastic theater.
Oh, that's the term I know to do with theater. It was something that Tennessee Williams was big into. He was big into plastic theater. That's all I know about theater. Sorry.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, it's so obviously when you read a play, there's almost no stage directions.
Yes.
Plastic theater was like, no. There should be plenty of stage directions, and it has to happen like this. You'd reference like lights and character actions. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted. Continue.
No, I like that. I guess. I want to comment on the difference of, or like the rarity of expressionist design in both, because I want to say that theater allows you to do a little bit more in terms of expressionism, because you have to be so loud, and that film directors, I'm saying, often kind of want a somewhat grounded approach in design, no matter what the story is. The design has to be familiar to a certain degree. And I'm going to go with that one. I'm going to go with that perspective. I think theater lets you be more expressionist, because the suspension of belief is ingrained into the viewing experience. Everyone who's in the theater knows what's happening. You know, if there's no props, a theater audience will live with that. They'll be like, fair enough. I see you're mimicking a phone. You have a phone. But in film, a design has to be familiar.
There's
to
like
a certain...
an expectation of perfection in film.
Exactly.
Which maybe doesn't exist in theater.
Yeah. I feel like film maybe even has a bit more, ironically, has a bit more of a pretentiousness to it when it comes to the making, like the behind the scenes process, in that sense of perfection, in that sense of realism. Because if you're missing a prop in film, you're fired. It is that simple. But also, a design has to be familiar in order for an audience to to relate to it. So if you're taking like Blade Runner, for example, or Backrooms, or German Expressionism, like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, they might be sci-fi or new settings that don't exist, but they are reminiscent of something that does exist.
Like a door's a door, regardless of if it's, you know, a hologram or a push door.
Exactly. Like Backrooms is an office or a swimming pool. Like the city in Caligari is a weird, wacky city. In theater, I think you can get away with it a little bit more. I've only done kind of realist theater, but even then, I kind of got away with a few things, just because we can chalk it up to, oh, they probably won't see it from this angle, or they won't. It's going to be fine. But personally, despite this, I love film. Film is my favorite medium to work with.
My favorite medium is crayons.
So I obviously I love making sets no matter what, but a frustration I have with film, even though I love it so much, is that kind of expectation of a degree of realism. And it's weird because it's in criticism and in awards and everything, there's a weird disconnect between what we really, really want to see films do and what we award films for doing. Like, everyone wants something new. We want something that hasn't been done before. Like, we want interesting sci-fi sets, big blah, 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 blah. And those get awarded, but the things that people are actually doing, like, over 70% of films being made in Britain are dramas. And obviously there's some, you know, sci-fi can be drama, etc. But generally speaking, dramas are fairly realistic in their setting and acting. Whatever that means. Yeah. Whatever that means. They're more grounded.
Yeah.
And so people award big sets and they really, critics want to see big, lavish things. But then when they get it, they don't appreciate the degrees of expressionism, I want to say. Because as I said earlier, even a bedroom expresses something so unique to that character and to that film. You'll never get two characters' bedrooms that look exactly the same. You never will. And yet you don't see, no one is like, oh, the production design of what's a bedroom?
It's where I sleep.
Exactly. But like, for example, even Adolescence, back when that came out, it's a one take show. So you can, you take all of the set in all of the time. I didn't see a single thing about the production design of that. Even though it's.
To be fair, I think in recent memory, one of the few times I can think of like a quote unquote realist set having articles dedicated to it, and even then it was only when I was researching it, was Normal People of all things. There was a lot of, the production designer was talking about like how everyone on set was praising it, because they were like, oh my gosh, you know, my teenage boy's room looks just like this.
That.
So yeah.
But it's not a common occurrence to kind of give these little sets some love, even though they say so much about every single aspect of this character. So there's a big disconnect.
Do you think the reason expressionist sets are maybe praised more than, you know, realist sets, despite needing, you know, just as much work, is because realist sets have something to be compared to, and, you know, it's whether or not you succeed in making it look like that, whereas expressionist sets, there's nothing to compare it to, so it's just like, go do your thing.
Absolutely. I mean, again, I'm kind of, in that regard, I'm the wrong person to talk to, because I'm so close to it. And when you say, like, there's nothing to be compared to in expressionist sets, everyone has a reference, that everything has a mood board and a reference and a concrete thing.
Sorry, I should clarify. I meant more like the audience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But from an audience perspective, a thing that I've kind of discovered is that a problem with production design in its reception is the fact that people will call it imitation. You are imitating someone's bedroom. You are imitating this living room. This realist set is so well designed that it is an imitation of a real space that people know and are familiar with. And so you do such a good, you're doing such a good job that people don't see your work and don't kind of consider it as work, but as an imitation of something that already exists, therefore as something that lacks originality. And that, I just think that's sad. It's really, really true. It's true. But as someone who works in it, like, it's a hard thing to describe, because production design sits in so much tension with so many contributing factors. Like, we have to be realist and original, and you can't balance all of it all of the time. And I think the main priority of production design is to support the story as a background. And background does not mean invisible, I want to argue. If I can leave this show with saying one thing, it's to tell everyone to watch films and look in the background, take in the set. You will learn so much more about the world you're being projected into, and you will find so much appreciation. Just from the smallest things. Like, I know I've watched, like, films and seen how characters decorate their room, and I've gone on to try and recreate it. I think it's the cutest thing ever, and I want everyone to do that.
That was a surprisingly touching end to the episode.
Are we at the end?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to signal to you, but you
I thought you were just giving me a high five.
Nope, I have never in my life done a high five with my fingers spread like that. That is absurd. You guys can't see this, but it almost looks like I'm doing a Spock. Anyway, before we end, thank you very much to Mika Lippel for coming on the show, talking German Expressionism and production design. A bit of a bleak one to end on, but and this is not news, but yesterday Sam Neill passed away. Yes. One of my favourite actors. Like, honestly, Jurassic Park was hugely influential on me, but more important than Jurassic Park was Jurassic Park 3, the one with the Spinosaurus. I can't remember if it was a VHS or if this was post VHS, but one of my grandparents had a copy of it, and I would watch it, like, endlessly, that Jurassic Park 3. And obviously, growing up, getting into horror, he is a horror legend in Possession and The Omen 3 and Event Horizon. And I think, yeah, the order film is a little dark without Sam Neill in it. But rest in peace to Sam Neill. Genuinely one of the greats. Thank you again to Mika.
Thank you so much. This was such an honor. If you ever want me back.
I'll think about it. But yeah, until next week, I have been Logan Parker, and this has been an absolute pleasure.
Bye.
Ciao. Can you suck in my champagne? And if you know what I'm saying, it's all mobile bonus shit. Got a good me, burger me, you're there. Odin, jump. Oh, 오래간만에 불장난해
지금 이 순간 나랑 같이 밖엔 아니겜 너는 빼지 않지 같이 함께 천국까지 맨 정신은 반지
우린 좀비에 후회 따위 내일에 조금 위험해
Hey man, you better slow it down
This is Westminster Waves.
Online, DAB and smart speaker.
The sound of student life in London.
Hello everyone and welcome to the next episode of The Lectern, the show where ideas meet experience, research meets reality and the voices behind our university community take center stage right here at Westminster Waves. I am Mohammed Ashraf Sheikh, aka Ash, currently pursuing my master's degree here at the university and I'm thrilled to be your host on this exciting journey. Each episode, we'll sit down with MSc students, PhD researchers and members of staff to uncover the stories behind their work, explore groundbreaking research, discuss academic challenges and achievements and discover what inspires them both inside and outside the classroom. Whether you are a student, researcher, educator, or simply curious about the people shaping our university, The Lectern is your front row seat to insightful conversations and fresh perspective. So grab a coffee, settle in, and join us as we shine a spotlight on the minds, ideas, and experiences that make our university community extraordinary. This is The Lectern, and the conversation starts now. So today, we have a very wonderful guest with us, Mr. Timo, in the Westminster Wave studio. Something about Timo. So Timo is a member of PhD Society and also a student of PhD Society within PhD student within the University of Westminster. And also he is serving as a vice president of Westminster PhD Society. So Timo, happy to have you here. Can you introduce yourself? Where are you from? And tell us what are you currently studying?
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me. So where I'm from, good question to start with. Within the university, I'm from the business school. Myself, however, I am a European construct. So born in Germany and then raised and lived and studied in Scandinavia, but also in various parts of Germany. So consider myself more European German than anything else. And I'm now in London since, the pandemic 2020. So almost 6 years now. And what I study is I am researching more the ideas behind how middle